Roman crucifixions were designed to be very public events. It was the policy of the imperial government that the form of execution that was designed to be most shameful and excruciating be used on those who had threatened the security of that government. Those who were not Roman citizens were especially vulnerable to a sentence of execution for crimes they were alleged to have committed against the state. By holding the crucifixions in public, often along heavily traveled roads, the Roman authorities sought to intimidate, and they did so very effectively, other members of the public who may have been contemplating similar deeds. Unlike modern executions, there were no lists of approved witnesses, nor any kind of security clearance required for those who wanted to watch others die. It was part of the routine of life under Roman domination. Even those who had purposed that they would avoid such scenes would still have been likely to have witnessed at least one such execution. The crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth was not then out of the ordinary in attracting a curious crowd of onlookers. By the time you would count those who were present there, because it was their job to be there, and you would add others who may have had some personal connection with those being put to death, and others who had other reasons for being there, you would have had a small throng of people. In the case of the crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, the inspired gospel writers provide us some insight into the perspectives of the various people in attendance. During our communion services this year, we're going to consider some of those who were witnesses at the cross. They run the gamut from deeply personal to callously official to viciously bitter. We begin today by considering one of the most interesting witnesses at the cross. He was the man who represented the power of the imperial government and whose responsibility it was to supervise the execution. He had attained the rank of centurion in the Roman army. He was in charge of a group of 100 soldiers. And a detachment from that group was assigned to the task of executing still more enemies of the empire. At least, they assumed that the men they were crucifying were enemies of the empire. But the leader of that band, and those who were serving with him on that execution detail, were in for one of their greatest surprises. For Jesus of Nazareth was obviously a person set apart from the run-of-the-mill series of people whom they had been called previously to put to death. They watched him there, the scriptures tell us. And by the time he died, by the time Jesus yielded up the ghost, the centurion at least had become so impressed that he concluded that this man must have been, as he claimed to be, the Son of God. How far the centurion's understanding went is something we can't know for certain. But we can know for certain that his words were true. When we listen to the centurion at the cross, we hear him confessing the truth. I want you to think upon that theme with me this morning. There are several other Roman centurions who are mentioned in the New Testament. Notably, Cornelius, of whom we may read in Acts chapter 10. Cornelius was the figure through whom the gospel began to be spread powerfully to the Gentiles. One writer from the period observed, centurions were chosen by merit, and so were men remarkable, not so much for their daring courage, as for their deliberation, constancy, and strength of mind. That is, Roman soldiers did not become centurions by bucking the system. They were men who were used to carrying out their orders diligently and without delay. Men whose emotions never got the best of them. If you became a centurion, it was an indication that you were a man who could command yourself as well as others under your charge. Such realities as those make the reaction of the centurion at the cross all the more remarkable. For these were professionals. They were not subject to the whims of emotion. But the centurion at the cross was struck by all that he witnessed, things that he had seen that had never accompanied any other crucifixion he had supervised. So it was that his testimony must be very compelling. If the centurion came to the conclusion that Jesus is the Son of God, then there is no excuse for anyone else not reaching that same conclusion. Now, there are four things concerning the centurion that I want you to observe as we prepare to partake of the elements of the Lord's Supper. First of all, doing his duty. Doing his duty, that really was the hallmark of the Roman centurion. If you wanted somebody who would do what he was told to do, that's who you would find. They did what was expected of them without question. But it was in the context of doing his duty on this occasion that the centurion observed things he had never seen in his life. Now, we're not told here what the centurion had been told or what he had heard or what he had learned about Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus of Nazareth was not an obscure figure. He was a public figure, and you can be sure that just about everybody had heard something about him. So it would not have been possible for the centurion never to have heard of Jesus before coming to this occasion. But as a Roman soldier, he would have been accustomed to dismissing much of what he heard about the Jews. The Roman soldiers heard things about the Jews all the time, and they were trained just to let them go, just to dismiss them. But when Jesus of Nazareth was being crucified, when he was going through the indignities associated with that death, the centurion heard him say something remarkable. And for that, we turn to Luke's Gospel, chapter 23. Luke 23. And verse 34. Then said Jesus, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Here is what Jesus said. They know not what they do. Don't you think that that got the centurion's attention? Don't you think that that would have unnerved the centurion? He was a man who was used to doing his duty. And if there was one thing about the centurion on which you could rely, it was that he knew what he was doing. He was competent. But here was Jesus saying, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. So how could Jesus, in the midst of the indignities of being crucified, how could he pray to God and ask forgiveness for those carrying out his execution and say that they didn't know what they were doing? But if he was unnerved by those words, he didn't let his feelings keep him from doing his duty. When the prisoners were secured to their crosses, the crosses were lifted into place in an operation that the soldiers had down pat, and the soldiers began the death watch. Now undoubtedly this centurion had watched numerous other prisoners in the throes of crucifixion. But with Jesus, there was something different. That leads me to the second thing I want you to notice. Beholding the suffering. The scriptures tell us in this very chapter that we have read that sitting down, they watched him there. There was something that drew their attention to him. There were two others who were crucified, two malefactors, as the scriptures tell us, who were crucified with Jesus. But it does not say to us that they watched them. They watched him. The soldiers, after having crucified Jesus, we are told, divided up his garments. Those that were sewed together that had seams, they tore those along the seams, and then they had his cloak that was all of one piece. It was all woven. There was no seam. There was no way to divide it, and they didn't want to tear it, so they cast lots for it. They drew straws or however they did it. They cast lots for it, and whoever got the lot, got the cloak. And even in so doing, they were fulfilling the scriptures, though they did not know what they were doing. But then, having done all those things, they sat down and watched him. Now, I want to tell you that in every other case, nearly, the scene of a crucifixion was marked by cursing and forms of invective, not only from those who were witnesses, but also from those who were being crucified. But Jesus said very little. It was obvious as they watched him that he was in anguish of body. You could not be crucified without being in anguish of body. You can go back to Psalm 22 and you can read something about the anguish of crucifixion. Crucifixion was designed to make those who were being put to death suffer extremely in the process. There was no talk in the Roman imperial government about how we can make the execution humane. The Romans didn't care about that. They wanted it to be as gruesome as possible. They wanted those who were being put to death to suffer as much as they could be made to suffer. But Jesus seemed to be, even though he was in pain, he seemed to be in command of his suffering. He seemed to be in calmness of mind. How could he behave in that way? They watched him there. There was something different about him. The time passed. The minutes turned into half hours. The half hours turned into hours. 3 hours went by. And then we read that the darkness descended. In verse 45 of Matthew 27, "Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour." For 3 hours, darkness descended, and it was for certain then that the centurion knew that this crucifixion was unlike any other he had supervised. For never had there been such an atmosphere at the scene of a crucifixion. Darkness descended. It was in the middle of the day. It was not a solar eclipse. There have been all sorts of efforts to explain this darkness. It was the hand of God dropping this darkness upon the land in similar fashion to the plague of darkness that had come to Egypt, the darkness that could be felt and that was felt for 3 days. The darkness descended. And now they couldn't see Jesus in the darkness. The time continued to pass. Minutes went by and still it was dark. They couldn't tell so much about the passing of time now, for they couldn't see the sun. And the half hours became hours. 3 hours of darkness. 3 hours. And then the climactic moment arrived. That's the third thing I want you to see. Feeling the terror. For suddenly we read that Jesus cried out from the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And those who were not familiar enough with his language said, well, he's calling for Elijah. When they heard those words, Eloi, Eloi, they said he's calling for Elijah. So they wanted to give him some refreshment so that he might be able to say more. And others said, no, let's just wait and see what happens. Maybe Elijah's going to come to take him down. And then he cried out again with a loud voice. And we know elsewhere what he said. He said, it is finished. And then he bowed his head and gave up the ghost. He dismissed his spirit and he died. And when he cried out with that loud voice and he dismissed his spirit, we're told in the passage that we read that the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom. And there was a violent earthquake and the rocks were split asunder. It seemed that all of nature was reacting to the fact that Jesus had finished his atoning work. That here was the Creator dismissing his spirit, laying down his life for his people. We don't have to wonder how the centurion responded. For we read here in the words of our text that when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, they feared greatly. It wasn't just a little bit of concern. You can see them looking around, hearing the noise of the earthquake. You can see them feeling the impact of all of nature responding to the death of Jesus Christ. And they were trembling. There was awe. And these events that occurred when Jesus died were unlike anything that had ever happened. Most victims of crucifixion died as a result of what we would call today a coup de grace. They used the term the crucifragrum. That is, they had a heavy metal club that they would use to break the lower legs of those who were on the cross so that they could no longer lift themselves up to breathe. That was how death came. But Jesus did not die in that way. He died after only 6 hours. Some victims of crucifixion took days to die. The events that occurred when Jesus died overwhelmed the centurion with that which shattered everything on which he had relied. And that brings me to the fourth thing, believing the gospel. The centurion said, truly, this man was the Son of God. Now I can tell you that commentators have had a field day with the language of our text. For it says literally, truly, this was God's Son. Or, truly, this was a Son of God. And so, commentators have tried to suggest that, well, the centurion was reacting in the context of his own pagan language and his own pagan religion. That he didn't know, really, what he was saying. That he didn't have any knowledge about the terms of the gospel. But I want you to look earlier in the passage. Because the centurion would have heard some of these things. In fact, he would have heard all of them. What the people who passed by said in verse 40, if thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross. Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. Then the chief priests who were mocking him, and the scribes, what did they say in verse 43? He trusted in God. Let him deliver him now if he will have him. For he said, I am the Son of God. So here they were reporting in the hearing of the centurion what Jesus had said. I am the Son of God. So to say that the centurion had no idea what this meant, I reject. If we turn to the other texts and the other synoptic gospels, we find some light shed upon this scene. Mark 15 and verse 39. And when the centurion which stood over against him saw that he so cried out and gave up the ghost, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. Now that would suggest that he understood the significance of the claim to be the Son of God as to be more than merely a man. Let's turn to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 23. And verse 46. And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. Now when the centurion saw what was done, he glorified God, saying, Certainly this was a righteous man. Now how could he be a righteous man if he were not God in the flesh? He glorified God. No, not one of the pagan gods, not Jupiter, or a god like that. He glorified God. Truly, this was the Son of God. Here was a statement which indicates to me that this centurion in that moment came face to face with the truth. That not only was Jesus unlike anyone else he had ever seen being crucified, he understood the truth that Jesus was a righteous man. That there was no warrant for him there to be put to death. Now it's interesting that we hear nothing about this centurion after this day. We don't find any other reference to him. But it was God's providence that on that day put him in that place where he could see demonstrated before his eyes the reality that Jesus is the Son of God. On that day, this witness at the cross came to grips with the truth as it is in Jesus Christ. We come this day to the table of the Lord, to come to grips with this truth again, that the one who suffered and bled for us on the cross is the Son of God. He is God incarnate, God manifest in human flesh, truly divine and truly human, two natures, not commingled or combined in any way, two distinct natures in one glorious person forever, the person of our Redeemer, the Lord Jesus Christ. We come with the centurion today to confess this truth as we take these elements into our own bodies. Truly, this man is a righteous man. Truly, this man is the Son of God. Truly, this man is our Redeemer and our Savior. We come to remember him. Let us do so today through faith in his glorious sacrifice.